Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Hello, and welcome to What Goes Up, a weekly markets podcast. My name is Mike Regan. I'm a senior editor at Bloomberg.
And I'm Valdana Hayek, a cross-asset reporter at Bloomberg.
And this week on the show, well, cryptocurrencies have been under pressure this year as the Federal Reserve and other central banks get ready to withdraw stimulus, and as tensions escalate between Russia and Ukraine. And in fact, the situation has gotten much more serious since we recorded this episode on Wednesday, with Russia launching a massive invasion of Ukraine. What do all these developments mean for digital assets? We'll get into it with the chief strategy officer at a big digital asset investment firm.
I want to welcome Meltem Demirers. She's the chief strategy officer at CoinShares. Meltem, thank you so much for joining us.
I am so delighted to be here, Valdana. We've been flirting online and offline for years now.
Years.
And I've always appreciated part of your coverage of the crypto space. Good to be here.
Me too. No one flirts with me, either online or offline. I don't know what,
maybe
I don't
for
know
a reason.
What I'm doing wrong. But, well, Meltem, let's get into it a little bit and tell our listeners about CoinShares. I mean, I think you're probably most well-known for exchange-traded products tracking Bitcoin and Ether, but a lot more going on with the company. So why don't you give us sort of a quick rundown of what's going on at CoinShares and sort of how you got into the space personally, into the crypto space.
I'd love to. And maybe I'll actually start with my journey into crypto first, because it's really relevant to who we are at CoinShares and why we do what we do. So before I got into crypto, I was actually in the oil and gas industry. I started on the trading side, then moved into the M&A side, and then into corporate treasury at ExxonMobil at a time, if you recall, many, many years ago, when ExxonMobil was in fact the largest company in the world by market capitalization of $400 billion, which today feels very paltry when we have companies with market caps of several trillion dollars. But at that time, this was less than a decade ago, you know, that was a pretty big deal. As I went to graduate school, I was at ExxonMobil, I was like, I don't know about oil and gas. The world was changing a lot. Everything was going digital. I'd never heard of venture capital or startups. Went to grad school at MIT, went down, you know, the startup VC rabbit hole, and had been personally interested in engaged with Bitcoin, but started interacting with a lot of Bitcoin startups. If you recall, it wasn't really until 2013 when Coinbase received its first round of funding, went through Y Combinator, that people were even investing in Bitcoin companies. At the time, it was really just Bitcoin. None of these other cryptocurrencies existed. Web3 didn't exist. DeFi didn't exist. And then as I was leaving grad school, I met Barry Silbert, who's starting Digital Currency Group. And when I met the CoinShares team, really what we bonded over is all of us come from the commodity space. So my business partners, they had launched and ran a commodities hedge fund. And again, if we look at the narrative cycle around commodities, if you recall, 20 years ago, commodities really weren't an investable asset class. A lot of commodities trading was done physically by firms who operated in the commodity space and the energy space who had a need to hedge, right? But it really wasn't a space with a lot of financial instruments or really active electronic market. And so what they saw that I think was so interesting and really the genesis of CoinShares was trading and market infrastructure, building market infrastructure. And what they saw that I think was so compelling, and I think so many other people who were early to crypto also saw from the commodity space, was this nascent market. It was already inherently digital, right? There was nothing physical that needed to be dematerialized, but the market infrastructure around Bitcoin didn't exist at all. So most of what I did for the first 5 years in the industry is invest in market microstructure, on and off ramps, and a lot of the basic elements of this market. And what's been really fascinating is over really until 2020, the crypto market operated largely outside of the traditional system. So outside of existing brokers, outside of existing exchanges, it didn't really even have its own access to banking system, which is why we saw the proliferation of stable coins, right? We needed a way to settle dollars on the same sort of rules that crypto settled with. Our journey at CoinShares really started with trading, thinking about market structure. We then got into the exchange trader product space. Most people know our legacy product line, XBT Provider, which was the first crypto ETP in the world. Started with Bitcoin. Now we have Ethereum and a bunch of others. The two biggest elements of our business today are asset management. We have three platforms: XBT Provider, CoinShares Physical, which is fully collateralized and sort of cold storage coins. And then we have a ETF that tracks crypto equities, which are also an exciting part of the market now. It's no longer just the digital assets themselves, it's also equities. We're also publicly listed, so that's been a fun process. And we definitely talk about the equity side of the crypto space. And then obviously what's underpinning all of that, we operate all of that infrastructure. We build all of that infrastructure. That's what makes the products possible. And then what I get to do, I have the best job in the company, I think. I get to think about what the future looks like. So I invest on our behalf and focus on investing, M&A, and growth. And so it's been really interesting over the last few years in particular to think about how asset management, how investments, how market microstructure are fundamentally changing and what the implications are for how we build and distribute financial products, particularly on-chain financial products and non-custodial financial products, which is a thing, you know, you would never have conceptualized even as little as 5 years ago. But now it's very much becoming a reality with hundreds of billions of dollars locked in these protocols that are managing money programmatically for individuals and institutions alike. So that's really the genesis of CoinShares. You know, we're a publicly listed company. We just reported our full year results for last year, so people can go and check that out. We have a pretty big research team that publishes all sorts of great insights on markets, whether that's the exchange traded product market, whether that's the equities market, whether that's crypto market structure, new assets in the crypto space. But it's been a fun journey over the last 4 years building that business and really thinking about constantly how we're going to disrupt ourselves, right?
I'm glad actually that you mentioned that you guys just reported earnings, because I wanted to ask you about that and what type of growth you're seeing or what you're seeing ahead for you guys.
Yeah, so for us, obviously, exchange traded products continue to grow. What's been really interesting is we see a lot more entrants into the ETP space, into the structured product space. I think one of the really cool things happened over the last 2 years, it used to be the only way people could really access crypto investing in the early days was through exchanges, right? And I recall my early days, you know, you'd send envelopes of cash, or you would try to wire money to a bank in China or Japan, and you'd hope that that would work out for you, or you'd use local Bitcoins. I remember when Circle came on the scene, and I was in Boston. Circle is a Boston company. Like, the ability to ACH or wire money into a platform by crypto was such a huge relief. But if we think about what's happened over the last 2 years, crypto is now accessible directly through dozens of both traditional fintechs as well as crypto native fintechs. We have Coinbase, Gemini, Kraken, a lot of others, but we also have Square and Robinhood and SoFi and others who make it really, really easy for people to manage their crypto in the same way they're managing their equities exposure, right? So I think that's been a really amazing development and has certainly made consumer on-ramp much simpler. An area I'm really excited about is putting crypto in IRAs and tax-advantaged accounts. I think that's a huge opportunity for this growth asset. We're investors in a company called Choice that does that, but Alto IRA does that, and others do that as well. And I think for us, the biggest area of growth is really continuing to think about how we can use our market infrastructure and all of the technology we've built at CoinShares to reach our consumers in different ways, our clients in different ways.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Yeah, Meltem, I wanted to ask you about sort of the institutional investor end of things. You know, correct me if you disagree with this, but I get the sense that for a lot of sort of individual retail investors, as you pointed out, there's so many easy ways to get yourself exposure to crypto. But I feel like the institutions are really such a big well of money there that potentially could come into the space. And my guess is they'd more likely be interested in an exchange traded product, something they're more comfortable with than, say, storing crypto themselves or going through, you know, direct exposure through a Coinbase. Where are institutions, in your opinion, as far as where on the curve are they as far as getting into crypto? It seems to me like we're just at the early days of them scratching the surface. What are the type of conversations institutions have about crypto as far as how much exposure they really want to get?
Yeah, that's been the topic in the crypto industry for quite some time. So let's just start by talking about how institutions typically allocate to new asset classes. For most, it starts with research, right? And it starts with actually an internal decision process around whether or not they want to engage with a specific asset class. Now, for Bitcoin in particular, for the longest time, you know, when I first went out to the street and tried to raise money for a Bitcoin business, people told me I was crazy. This was 2015. 2017, 2018, everyone wanted to do blockchain, but we weren't really clear what that meant, but everyone was doing blockchain. I think what was really interesting about what happened in 2020, particularly when individuals like Bill Miller and, you know, Stan Druckenmiller came out and said, and Paul Tudor Jones, right, came out and said, I'm allocating to Bitcoin. I have long-term conviction in this asset. It made it acceptable for institutions, for chief investment officers, for investment committees, for risk review committees to start looking at the asset, right? They've been doing a little bit of research. And I'll say there are some firms that were really, you know, forward-looking and started doing research as early as 2017, 2018. But it was really in 2020 when people started saying, okay, this is an asset class. Maybe we're willing to consider it. We're willing to talk about it. And what I think is happening now is institutions definitely want to add crypto exposure. I mean, all you have to do is look at the margins in this business. Banks are in the business of making money. Financial firms are in the business of making money. There is an industry that is printing billions of dollars of revenues, right? They're going to get in that game. That's what they're in. For them right now, the challenge is how do they mesh the way they're accustomed to interacting with assets with this new thing, a digitally native asset that settles with Finality on a public network, right? That's a little bit different. So the CME cash settled futures product has been really popular with institutions because it fits within their existing infrastructure, doesn't require many new processes internally. The only risk they're really taking there, right, with the CME as a counterparty with this cash settled contract is the asset risk. And that's really what's been the biggest thing for us at CoinShares is thinking about articulating those different risks and then qualifying, quantifying those different risks and finding wrappers and constructions, because the only risk they really want to have, right, is asset level risk. They don't want to have market risk. They don't want to have counterparty risk. They want to try to minimize that. They certainly don't want to have some contract risk, which is something you face with these DeFi products. So I think a lot of institutions through this sort of risk review phase. And now the question is, do we build, buy, or partner to start to offer these capabilities? So we've partnered, for example, with Invesco on the ETF side, and that's been a great partnership. Asset manager, massive asset manager, who really wants to get into the crypto space, partnering with a crypto native firm like us gives them an accelerated way to do that. And we've seen a lot of partnerships of that type. We're also seeing folks buying, right? We've seen a number of financial institutions acquiring companies in the crypto space or evaluating the opportunity to acquire, although valuations are pretty high these days. And then some are building, right? But the issue with building is it takes a lot of time. It's really difficult to find talent. And at the end of the day, I'm not certain that the culture at institutions is necessarily built around keeping pace with an industry that's so dynamic and constantly evolving. But I think right now, that's really where most institutions are at. They have internal approval. The board is on board. Shareholders, you know, I find it compelling. We've certainly seen when companies around there announce to do something with crypto, right? We see a share price pop. So it's certainly value creative. I think now the question is, how do they actually deliver on that in a meaningful way? And what does that timeline look like? next 2 to 3 years, it's going to be table stakes for every asset manager, every financial institution to offer crypto-related services. I don't think many of those will be on-chain. I think they'll find ways to wrap those assets to make them custodial and to minimize some of the risks that they perceive with engaging with crypto assets in a more way.
Has the price action we've seen over the last few months sort of slowed that momentum at all, thrown some cold water on it?
Absolutely not. What I think has been interesting, the argument we used to get or the pushback we used to get when we'd speak to institutions about allocating to Bitcoin was around Bitcoin's volatility. And as we've seen over the last 2 years, volatility is no longer limited to just Bitcoin. I think we've seen volatility all across the asset landscape and all across the portfolio landscape. So I think as a sort of a mindset shift has happened over the last 2 years where everything else has gotten much more volatile, so I think institutions are much more comfortable with Bitcoin's inherent volatility. And in some ways, that volatility actually can be an asset, particularly on the fixed side or the trading side or the prime brokerage side, right? Which are big profit centers for many financial institutions. You know, volatility is when you make money. Vol is good for traders. So I think that volatility has gone from criticism to now being sort of a reality and potentially an opportunity for firms.
So the big news, obviously, this week is Russia-Ukraine tensions. And I wanted to ask you what happens to Bitcoin prices as things sort of escalate in the coming days, because the thought used to be, at least a couple of years ago, I remember hearing a lot about, for example, Venezuela, like Bitcoin, whenever something was happening in an unstable country, people could potentially use Bitcoin or start to use Bitcoin a bit more. So how should we be thinking about what happens to Bitcoin's price as these Russia-Ukraine tensions escalate?
Yeah, Vildana, I think that's a huge question. If I had a crystal ball, right, I would be trading this. I sadly don't have a crystal ball. What I think is interesting is you alluded to, I think one of the narratives around Bitcoin historically has been Bitcoin is an antidote to chaos and government incompetence. Right. And I think in many ways, historically, gold was also viewed that way. Right. And we're seeing right now gold is having its little moment. It's rallying. I think one of the big questions around Bitcoin in particular in this environment is we don't know what's going to happen. Right. A matter of weeks is not really going to reveal what correlations might exist between Bitcoin and other sort of macro trends, political trends, cultural trends, et cetera. I think it's a bit too early to say. I think certainly Bitcoin in an inflationary environment has been something we've been waiting for a long time. And we are going to look at the data like we do at CoinShares research team. We're going to continue looking at correlations, decorrelations, and where things shake out. But again, I'm hesitant to make any sort of definitive conclusions. I think, again, things we don't have, unfortunately, in this asset class is a long time series of data to look at to allow us to make inferences. Things have changed so much fundamentally that it's very difficult to pinpoint like what's happening in markets. I think everyone's a little bit perplexed and confused, to be candid. And if you look at the way things are trading in markets, like it's wild. So I don't have a clear answer to that. I think for us, we're going to continue watching. We're going to continue looking at the data. As I always say, I love to bring receipts. I have CVS receipts, baby. They are long. So we want to get some more data. We want to look at this over a longer time scale. But certainly, we're optimistic around this idea that people will continue to look at Bitcoin as a portfolio diversifier, an effective portfolio diversifier in an environment of increased chaos and uncertainty.
You know, to me, I think the one thing that skeptics of crypto sort of seize on is that the narrative bull case for crypto tends to be kind of a moving target. You know, as you say, government chaos and sort of geopolitical chaos was one selling point. Obviously, monetary inflation being sort of one of the evergreen bull cases for crypto. Is it just natural then to expect a correction like this when central banks start moving in the other direction and tightening policies? I mean, is that the main catalyst, you think, for what we've seen, this drop in crypto prices over the last few months? Is it as simple as that, or is there more going on, do you think?
I think there's more going on. So if we look at how much Bitcoin has dropped, Bitcoin is down around 40% from its last high in November of around 69,000. So it's down 45%. If we look at tech equities are down and around 30 to, in some cases, like 90%, right? So we've seen drawdowns in that asset class, which is technically considered sort of growth assets. We've seen more traditional value stocks like core equities rallying a bit, right? But I think across the board, there is a growing awareness. And I think it's not the Ukraine-Russia conflict that's highlighted this, but it's what's been happening in Canada with the trucker protests and the Canadian government cutting off financial access to people who are involved in these protests. People in the West, right, historically, and the majority of capital markets activity is still, by and large, in the United States and in the Western Hemisphere. If we look at what's happened in the West, people in the West have never really conceptualized a situation like Venezuela or Greece or Turkey. Like, it just, I think as we watch what's unfolded over the last few weeks and months, with new regulation being proposed around surveilling bank accounts with balances over $600 and some of the new rules and the increased oversight and the lack of financial privacy that's coming down the pike, I think people just globally are becoming more aware of the fact that moving into the digital age and our lives being so driven by technology on a day-to-day basis, every facet of our lives, also has some profound implications for our self-sovereignty and the level of freedom we enjoy. And so I actually think for many people, it has catalyzed a renewed interest in how Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies could potentially be part of their lives in the future. And, you know, what I always say is taking a small percentage of your portfolio, allocating it to Bitcoin, it's a form of insurance, right? If we're wrong and everything else works out, great, you're covered. But if we're right, the fact that this is still such an asymmetrical risk-reward asset makes it worthwhile making that small allocation. That's how I view it. And when I speak to people, that's sort of how I articulate it. And again, there are risks. I certainly don't think, you know, that there aren't risks here. And certainly it's important to convey those. But I think around the world, just people are becoming more aware of the potential impact technology, and particularly financial surveillance technology, will have on their lives. And they're starting to think more critically about it. I mean, we've been locked in our houses for the last 2 years. Investing has become a form of entertainment. And I think generally people are looking around them and they're asking, what do we do from here? Especially for my generation. Like, we got screwed by the financial crisis, that's away from college, no jobs, set back, you know, 4 or 5 years. You're in your 30s. So what are you going to do? It's really, I think, an interesting shift that's happening. It's a generational shift. And I do think what's interesting is there's a tremendous amount of capital in the crypto space. You know, we talk about institutions for a long time. When we thought about institutions, we thought about banks. Now, when we think about institutions, we actually think about crypto native institutions with a tremendous amount of capital, a huge amount of capital. And so it's no longer just the traditional players. There is a new world. There's a new set of power players, and they're spending a lot of money. They're moving fast, very aggressive in this land grab for not just mind share, for attention, and for share of wallet. And that shift is happening very rapidly.
So, Meltem, you mentioned the Canadian trucker situation that's been unfolding. And I actually have a question about that from one of our new colleagues, one of our new crypto team members, Emily Nicole in London. And she said, you know, she's followed your work for a really long time. And you had said in the past that Bitcoin was the only way to fight for America's core freedom values. And so she was wondering, actually, if you still think that, considering everything that's been happening on the Canadian border with the intervention.
Absolutely. Democracy dies in darkness. And I think one of the core tenets that America was built around was the right to free speech and the right to personal freedoms. I think financial violence is actually the predominant form of violence in our world today. If we look at the impact that sanctions have on people's lives, financial redlining, financial exclusion, et cetera, we now, with this new technology, see new tools being added to the state arsenal, right, around monitoring, surveillance, and not just on the crypto side, but just with digital finance more broadly, and with the elimination in many societies, many countries of cash. And so what starts to become really interesting and concerning is we see governments, and this is not just totalitarian governments, but governments in the West also, right, that have historically been more permissive, they're utilizing financial violence as a tool to suppress certain types of activity, as a tool to suppress certain views. We have people, politicians, going on television and publicly stating, if we don't like what you have to say on social media, we will remove you from social media and remove you from this platform, but we'll also potentially, you know, impose other limitations on what you can or can't do. And I think that very rapidly starts to become dystopian. So I am concerned, and I do think it's very important for us to continue educating, to continue advocating. And again, like, a free society is not possible without free money, because money is inherent in everything we do. From the moment we wake up to the moment we go to sleep, we're constantly transacting. If you don't have the ability to transact with digital money, right, within the sort of state oversight banking system, you can't do anything. And if you hear some of the comments from people in Canada who've been involved in the protests, even, for example, a coffee shop who sold coffees, right? They're in the business of selling coffee. People come in and buy coffee. There's a coffee shop that was literally cut off from the banking system, had all their accounts frozen because they served coffee to people who were protesting. I mean, I think that's absolutely bonkers.
Meltem, let's shift to a slightly more happy topic, NFTs. I love to talk about NFTs. And Valdana's notes to me say that you are an NFT investor yourself. Is that right?
I am a JPEG connoisseur, yes.
All right. I want to hear about your collection, but I also want to hear after that about how do NFTs fit into the strategy for a firm like CoinShares? I mean, I have a hard time picturing like an NFT ETF or sort of, you know, any sort of way for you to put the, you know, NFTs on the exchange, the regular securities exchange. But, you know, am I wrong about that? Is there a way, you know, is there a strategy in place to sort of bring NFTs into a security form? Or is there other ways for a company like CoinShares to sort of, you know, get involved in the business?
Yeah, absolutely. And we talk about NFTs a lot internally. In 2018, we hosted an event in New York, and we worked with one of the first NFT projects called Ether Lambos to make a CoinShares digital Lamborghini. We made 200 of them. Only 20 were claimed at this event. And now they're trading under, I think, $14,000 or $15,000 each. So it's been pretty interesting, right? But I think, again, for us, if we take a step back, what are NFTs? In the absence, right, of physical sort of communities that are gathering and people being able to denote their belonging to a certain group, right? We don't really identify so much by like what nationality we are, what our occupation is, what our religious belief is. Today, the way we express who we are online is through the content we share, right? And what we post on our profiles. And so I think NFTs are actually a really interesting articulation of that in an online fashion and with capital embedded in it. It's similar to, in some ways, you know, why do people buy Rolexes? Why do people buy expensive cars? They want to make statements about who they are and their taste and their views, and they want to denote that they have taste, right? And that could be classy, it could be funny, it could be crass, it could be gauche, like whatever it is you prescribe to, there is an NFT out there for you, which I think is quite funny. And I think, again, the way that becomes an expression in an asset management firm is, I think there are certain collections of NFTs that have reached sort of blue chip status, as we like to call it, that have had value over time, that have retained value over time and grown in value over time. So I do think you'll start to see synthetics emerging around the NFT space, where you don't actually have to own the underlying NFT, but you can own a basket of synthetic exposure to specific NFT collections. And so you can start to build sort of these portfolios. And we've invested in a number of projects that are building synthetics around NFTs, which I'm pretty excited about. One of them is called GooseFX. It's built on top of Solana. So if you own a valuable NFT, instead of selling it to get liquidity, you can actually collateralize it and utilize it as a way to get liquidity. I think there's actually a company working on letting you use blue chip NFTs to buy a house, right? So to get a mortgage, which is also quite interesting. We're starting to see NFT lending products. So I do think the financialization of everything, right? One expression of that is certainly NFTs. And I think as we continue to push further into these more esoteric ways of building communities and sort of expressing who we are through conspicuous spending, which certainly NFTs are, the second piece that I think is important to remember about NFTs is it's not just about the assets themselves. Just like with crypto, it's not just about the assets themselves. There's also a ton of equities, right? There are companies who are creating tremendous amounts of value in the NFT ecosystem, building infrastructure to make all of this possible. So we are investing in those companies. We are actively collaborating with those companies as well. And I think we will see in the next 3 to 5 years, companies that publicly list that derive the majority of their revenues from participation in the NFT market. If we look at NFTs as an asset class, right, today, crypto assets themselves are roughly a $2 trillion asset class. Crypto equities, right, including publicly listed and privately held companies, are probably another $1 to $2 trillion of value. And the NFT space, right, the assets plus the infrastructure that's been built around NFTs close to a $1 trillion asset class as well. So what's been interesting to observe is there are many different ways that you can express that investment thesis based on how you like to invest. And I certainly would not ignore what's happening on the equity side. And it's not just crypto companies. There are also traditional companies that are starting to move into the NFT space. You know, as we saw GameStop, meme stock, they're now going to be an NFT platform. So again, you know, I think reinvention and constant change, that's the only constant really in financial markets. And I think NFTs are a really interesting expression of that. And certainly we're seeing a lot of activity, not just within the crypto ecosystem, but also outside the crypto ecosystem, and also the utilization of NFTs in this broader sort of Web3 ecosystem, as they call it, or this idea where instead of platforms owning our online experiences and monetizing them, users and creators alike can own pieces of the platform.
If you haven't noticed, Mike asks multi-part questions. So I'm going to pull a mic and ask you a multi-part question, which is, I want to ask you about your collection and how big your collection is, what you're buying right now, and what you think is the most overhyped NFT collection right now.
I love it. Valdana's like, give me the alpha lady. opens the open right now. Like, are you about to buy some NFTs?
Yeah, whatever you say, I'm just going to do it.
Okay, I'll be careful then. NFTs, I'm excited about. So I'll be very candid. I did not get NFTs for a long time, right? Which is, I'm perfectly happy to admit that I don't understand everything happening in crypto, and that's fine. So NFTs I started to get into last year. I came across something called Ether Rocks, which is an NFT project from 2017. It's 100 pictures of the same rock, just in slightly different colors, not particularly attractive, no roadmap, like it's a rock. And I bought an Ether rock for about 9 ETH at the time. And one of the cool things that happened is through participating in the Ether rock community, we actually started to build a physical community around these Ether rocks. Today, the owners of the Ether rocks comprise a really cool group of individuals from across the crypto space. There are startup founders in it. There are professional poker players. There are athletes. There are celebrities in it. So we've built this really cool sort of online community that's also convened offline. And I think we see that with a lot of NFT communities. I personally love Ether Rocks, and I own Ether Rock number 69, which is obviously, I'm here for the culture. So I find that super funny. I think I personally don't own CryptoPunks or Bored Ape Yacht Club apes, but those have been really popular and I think have had persistent value. Crypto Covens, which are these like 10,000 witches that exist online, they've built a really cool community. And that's really interesting because it's sort of a female-focused, female-led project and has seen a lot of growth in that community. And other projects, you know, I recently got involved in an NFT community called Crypto Dick Butts, which is, I'm like a Reddit kid. I grew up on the internet in the 90s. So, you know, I was on like 4chan and Something Awful and like all these weird online communities. And dick butts have been an internet joke forever. So someone actually made these little pixelated dick butts. And that's been really funny. That community, it's just very irreverent. As you can tell, I gravitate towards NFTs that are like silly and a little bit irreverent and a little bit cheeky. But I've also been collecting some really cool one-of-one pieces, some generative art as well. And I think there is this interesting intersection between physical art and digital art who have made physical paintings, buying the NFT, and then I can have the physical painting in my house, look at it, but I can also have the digital representation, sort of take it with me online. But yeah, I'm not a, you know, I buy funny NFTs. Anytime a new NFT comes out, okay, I'm going to mess around with this. Again, my job really is to learn and to understand. So I spend a lot of time doing because it helps me understand and contextualize and figure out how it fits into our business. You know, the NFT space is super fun. They're really low cost NFTs too that you can buy. A lot of these are like hundreds of thousands of dollars. The Grail NFTs or the blue chips are quite expensive. But in the Solana ecosystem, you know, there are a lot of NFTs that you can buy for less than one soul. So you could, you know, buy an NFT for 40, 50 bucks. And I do think because gas fees on Ethereum are quite expensive, we will see NFTs on other ecosystems that will get mass market involved. A cool stat I heard recently is Coinbase NFT has a wait list of 3.7 million users. So when those come online, that'll triple the current size of the NFT wallet by number of the NFT market in terms of number of wallets participating. And again, they'll be able to reduce fees and do things in a more retail friendly way. So I do think those on and off ramps for NFTs are really going to start to matter as well.
your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.
You know, Meltem, I don't know how many sort of old grumpy guys like me you've come across over the years who will say something like, oh, crypto has no cash flow. I don't know how to value it, which fine, we could argue that, debate that for another time. But then you ask them to sort of value an NFT, and I think it makes people's heads spin to try to sort of figure out if there is a way to fundamentally look at the potential value of an NFT.
Well, there is.
I'm curious how you do it, because to me, it's all about, well, how hype, you know, how much hype is behind this? How much sort of the community is going to be sort of backing this and hyping it up on social media? I mean, is that a big part of it, or am I just sort of looking at it superficially?
Nope. So I think there's a really interesting company called Upshot. And they actually specialize in valuing and pricing NFTs. And one of the interesting things they look at, and they have a great white paper on their site that you can read, look, in investing in anything, right, there's a certain element of fundamental analysis, but there's also a certain component of luck, right? It's very difficult to determine what NFT will be successful and what won't. Similar to what I do, right, when I'm investing in startups, there's an element of analysis that you can apply, but there's also a certain element of luck, right? And one of the reasons that we create portfolios of assets, right, in similar sectors or these portfolios is to attempt to reduce the influence of luck on financial outcomes, right? So that the mean of the performance across the portfolio sort of will perform well, right, and will to like eliminate or at least reduce the impact of luck in each individual investment decision you're making, right? So I think right now there's not a huge amount of data. Again, NFTs are 2 years old, but really a lot of these assets are very new. But Upshot's developed some pretty cool models. They've launched a really cool API that you can utilize that will do actually price predictions. So you can start to figure out what NFTs are undervalued or overvalued. And again, I think as we look at portfolio construction, there are all these interesting analytical tools that are starting to be built that will allow you to evaluate, not just utilizing price data, but contextual data, social graph data. Again, all of this is on-chain, it's public. You can see what other assets people hold in their wallets. All of this is starting to build, I think, a much more robust data set around how we can analyze esoteric assets like NFTs, contextualize valuation, and start to determine what's overvalued, what's undervalued, what has long-term sort of value proposition. But again, I think all this is quite new, but highly recommend Upshot. I'm an investor in the company, full disclosure. But I think, again, the space around analyzing, contextualizing what's happening and who's buying what and what that means and how that impacts pricing is a really rich space that a ton of companies are building in. It'll take a couple of years, I think, to really start to become more of a science. Right now, it's sort of pseudoscience. So many things are when they first start. But I think, again, with time, with more data, with better tooling and infrastructure, it certainly can be a very interesting asset class that presents opportunities for people who are deploying different types of strategies, whether it's an arbitrage strategy, whether it's a value investing strategy, whether it's a growth investing strategy, right? All of those things ultimately can be applied to these new types of markets as well.
Is that the kind of startup that's sort of catching your eye as a venture investor? Is, you know, that sort of analysis and type of thing?
Yeah. So the way I think about it is, so I think along two axes, utopianism and grift, right? So a lot of crypto products, I'm serious. And I want to give a shout out to Kevin at Galois Capital, who came up with this framework, which I've adopted and sort of permutated to fit my own needs.
Those are not the two axes I saw coming. That's pretty good. Utopianism and grift.
Yeah. So look, there's some projects that are low utopianism and low grift. And those I would categorize as infrastructure, right? It's like building a crypto exchange that's low utopianism. Like, we know in exchanges, you have an order book, you have bids and offers, right? Like, yeah, that's not high utopianism. It's not fundamentally revolutionary. It's also low grift, right? The business model is very clear. You know exactly how that works. Then there are projects which are really high utopianism and low grift. And these are typically very technical projects that are based on like one or two fundamental sort of technology breakthroughs. So I would categorize those there. And those are sort of like your moonshots. Then you have low utopianism grift projects, which are like shitcoins and NFT money grabs, as I like to call them. It's really just about optimizing for getting as much money out of people as possible. And a lot of those projects we've seen come and go over the years. I think it's very common in any new technology sector to see those types of projects, startups, companies. And then there's high utopianism, high grift. And those are the ones I sort of worry about. Now, things can migrate between sectors, right, as they become more real. But that's sort of an interesting like 2x2 matrix that you can sort of use to contextualize. Again, it sounds probably crazy to a more traditional investor who's not accustomed to thinking about the world this way. I think it'll sound more familiar to startup investors and people who look at the venture and startup space. But look, at the end of the day, like, you have to have a certain degree of optimism and a certain degree of belief in a radically different future. So I do think the utopianism and sort of this belief that we can do radically different things is really important. And over time, that will become normalized, right? But it's also important to be aware of the grift component. There's a lot of stuff in the crypto space that just when you stop to think about it, doesn't make sense at all. So that's sort of my framework.
So you're okay with it being sort of out there on the utopian axis, but lower on the grift axis, but presumably, or you want it sort of close to zero on both.
Yeah, exactly. I think again, intention is really important, and it's very important to sort of understand like the economics of the project, the vesting of the project, particularly since there is a much quicker pathway to liquidity in crypto through tokenization or through issuing an NFT. And so you always want to have a clear understanding of what the economic incentives are, what the timeframe is, and to ensure that those incentives are aligned around people building things that have actual utility.
Vildana, we need to somehow make a chart, a utopian grift chart.
Yeah, I was trying to picture it in my mind. I'm sure one exists that Meltem can share with us.
It's sort of an interesting way to contextualize things, but also to test my own thinking. It's very appealing, I think. It's very seductive to many crypto investors to be like, oh, we can make a lot of money very quickly. But again, I think that persistence is really important. Like, you want to invest in things that are going to be around for a long time. And ultimately, one of our fundamental beliefs is one of the beliefs I've always had. I've been in this industry for 8 years, which is a very long time. Reputation does matter, particularly in capital markets. Relationships do matter, even though we're operating in this digital space. It does matter. And so I do think it's important for people and for firms as they're investing in the space, as they're talking about things on Twitter. Like, you have to be cautious around what you're promoting, what type of behavior you're promoting. And so that's a line we sort of try to be very mindful of. And again, I do think we see other firms in the space, absolutely fine, right? To each their own. We're not judge, we're not jury, we're not executioner, but it's something to be mindful of. And again, CoinShares, we've been around for 8 years now. We plan to be around for decades more. And so that's how we're going to build our business.
Meltem, I wanted to ask you, it's going to sound like a simple question, but actually I think the story behind it is really interesting and very fascinating to me. I want to ask you where you're talking to us from, because you and I have talked about this idea about people building Bitcoin communities, especially in New Hampshire and in other places. And you and I have talked about how potentially you could see in the future people running for office on these Bitcoin community platforms. And so where are you calling us from, and what does this Bitcoin community development, I don't know if project is the right word, but what does it look like and where is it happening?
I love this topic, Vildana, so thank you for giving me an opportunity to shill New Hampshire. Look, I think at the end of the day, you know, I used to be in New York. I was in New York for many years. And New York, in my view, still is in many ways the capital of the financial world. What's been really sad to see is New York implemented 2015 called the Bit License that required firms operating in New York to obtain additional licenses specific to just dealing in cryptocurrencies. Now, very few Bit licenses have been issued. The average wait time from application to getting a Bit license is, I think, over 2 years at this point, and the wait list is quite long. They're not processing these things. So what's been really sad to see is certain states have effectively excluded them from this entire sector by having a very, I think, draconian approach or very inflexible approach to crypto, if you will. The other challenge you have operating in the US, and one of the reasons why CoinShares is a global firm with offices in multiple jurisdictions, is the US in many places lacks regulatory clarity, and the approach the US has chosen to take is regulation by enforcement, which again, I think is a really challenging approach. It's not that firms don't comply, it's just the guidance isn't clear. People are trying to do innovative things. They're new. I understand it's challenging for regulators to sort of figure out how to manage that. But regulating by enforcement and being kingmaker, right, which is what the SEC is doing by deciding who can and who cannot, is not a fair market approach. That's not how regulation is supposed to work. I think other jurisdictions like Switzerland, Singapore, and others that have taken a more proactive approach, that have established clear guidance through regulation as opposed to enforcement, have seen a lot of crypto firms, a lot of high-paying jobs, a lot of capital moving into those jurisdictions. I think Balaji Srinivasan does a great job articulating this. He recently wrote an article in a policy, sort of political science-focused publication around sort of the rise of digital nation-states, or nation-states that embrace new technology, that have regulation that's accretive to startups and you know, innovative entrepreneurs who want to build innovative types of businesses. And I think the physical infrastructure also matters. So what I really love about New Hampshire is from a tax perspective, it's quite amenable. From a regulatory perspective, you know, it's the live free or die state. So it's not overly prescriptive in how it regulates. And I think, again, there's a huge opportunity here for jurisdictions to compete for all of these tech workers that have been living on the coast. California and New York are two of the most regulated states in this country. So people are flocking to jurisdictions like Wyoming and Texas and New Hampshire and Florida, where there is an embrace of these new industries, where policies are not as restrictive, and where there is an openness to engaging, because these states, the opportunities to bring high-paying, high-tech jobs to their economies, and obviously that influx of capital and that influx of people has a huge impact, not just on people working in that sector, but on those states overall.
The live free or die. So it's more than just a license plate slogan in New Hampshire there.
Tighten up your straitjackets. It's time for the craziest things we saw in markets this week.
All right, Meltem. Well, for this next segment, I also have two axes in mind. This is called the craziest things we saw in markets this week. So on one axis is crazy, and on the other axis is also crazy. It's both crazy.
I think when I think about chaos, right, there's like bad chaotic, neutral chaotic, good chaotic. I think right now markets are like bad.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I'm hoping to get back to good chaotic. Crypto in some ways, like 2021 in many ways was good chaotic because it's fun.
Yeah.
Right now it's not so fun.
This is not so fun, but certainly plenty of things to talk about for the craziest things. Well, Donna, let's get started with you. What's the craziest thing you saw? And keeping in mind, you were in Portugal for most of the week, so I don't know. I don't know if that factors into your selection this week.
Yeah, but I have one that I specifically chose for you because I think you will really like it.
Oh,
and I really actually hope you haven't seen it yet. But Family Dollar, which is owned by Dollar Tree, it's actually closed like hundreds of stores and recalled a bunch of products because of a rodent infestation that they have.
I saw that.
It's a nauseating story, but it's also kind of unbelievable. So I guess CNN had a report that showed, you know, there were just like rats running around everywhere eating the food, and they were rotting garbage and trash and all kinds of stuff. And the stock did drop. So
wow, that is
so they had to recall a bunch of stuff too. I don't know if the stock dropped, you know, in conjunction with everything else selling off this week, but
well, it's,
it was fun. It was a fun read.
I think it's safe to say that some market moves are hard to determine. Rat droppings, closing your stores, I think is definitely a catalyst that
hundreds of stores. Yeah.
Well, Meltem, I don't know if you saw anything crazy.
God, what's crazy. I saw a chart this week that tracked tech IPOs over the last 2 years and the performance of those stocks. That was crazy to see, just
pretty bad
how far they are down. Yeah, from their peak. The other crazy thing, I guess, that's really on my mind is I have a lot more competition in early stage investing. Tiger, D1, a bunch of other later stage growth equity firms that would typically invest pre-IPO have said they're not going to be investing pre-IPO so much anymore. They're going to be in liquid public markets looking for undervalued tech companies, or they're going to move earlier stage to startups. So that's been interesting to see. It's certainly changed the venture landscape, and I think we'll continue to. There's more capital than ever chasing opportunities, but where they're chasing those opportunities is starting to shift. People generally are much more comfortable moving further out on the risk curve. And also on the duration curve, which has been interesting to observe. And I think the impacts of that will be felt throughout, you know, the tech sector for a long time to come. There's over 1,000 unicorns in the world today. No idea how those companies are going to get liquidity. I think what's happening around SPACs is also been fascinating to watch. A lot of new rules coming out, limiting the ability to raise SPACs, and a ton of SPACs that have raised capital but can't deploy it. So I think just generally, you know, the liquidity landscape for startups and companies in the tech space is starting to look very precarious.
Yeah, it just seems like there was just so much money in private capital, just looking for private market investments. It's amazing. All right, I'm going to take you, Vildana, to a market we have not discussed before. London real estate, okay? This is a story by our own Lisa Fleischer. A London flat is up for auction. Very small flat, 75 square feet. So to picture that, if that were a rectangle, that would be 7.5 feet by 10 feet. It's irregularly
shaped.
Square feet
or square meters?
Well, yeah, you'd have to convert it to meters, but we did not convert it to meters. 75-foot square apartment. It has a bathroom. Of course, you know, when you shower, the water lands on the toilet and the sink and everything. It's this tiny little bathroom. So I want you to guess what the asking price is for this 75-foot square foot flat, about the size of a prison cell, I would say. And I will point out that this is on the crazy access. The price access is not necessarily what drew my attention to this. It's just the tiny nature of the apartment.
Oh, I see. So the price might not be crazy. I'm going to say £300,000.
£300,000. I'm going to keep a poker face. Melton, what's your bid for a 75 square foot London apartment?
Let's go with £5 million.
£5 million. Wow.
I lived in New York, baby. I've seen it all.
Oh my gosh. I think you guys will be hearing from some London realtors very soon, both asking you to bid on this apartment. They're set to auction it for £50,000, which I find is kind of reasonable for a little, you know, bunk bed apartment in London. You know, I don't know.
Yeah, I thought for sure you were going to say like $400,000 or $500,000.
I said it's not the price, it's the size of the apartment that's crazy, not the price. So we'll see. Maybe it will go for £5 million. Melton's going to go buy it for $5 million to prove us wrong, I think.
I'm not buying it. I read another article about a building in Knightsbridge where apartments were selling for like £250 million. That was interesting.
A lot of money floating around. Well, Melton, I think that's all the time we have. Really appreciate your insights. Fascinating conversation. We didn't even get to the whole Bitcoin energy issue, which I hope we can have you on sometime to talk about that.
Actually, crazy. European Parliament just came out with a decree that they want to ban all proof of work based cryptocurrencies, which is going to be really interesting. We published a lot of research at CoinShares around Bitcoin's energy consumption. It is over 70% renewables driven. It's greener than most other industries in our world today. I think it is really a straw man for governments not liking Bitcoin. So, you know, that's my
all right. Well, she got it in there, Vildana. We'll have to have her back on to unpack that a little bit, because that is certainly such a huge issue for crypto. Melton, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks. And excited to be here and excited to see what your audience thinks.
Thank you, Melton.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Reganonymous. Katie Greifeld is at K Greifeld. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. And thank you to Charlie Pell of Bloomberg Radio. What Goes Up is produced by Laura Carlson. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.